Thank you, Alan, and thanks for not forgetting both your term and my term with the Resource Assessment Commission. And I'd just like to perhaps draw your attention to one thing the audience might be interested in. When in Alan's time as a commissioner with the Resource Assessment Commission, he was very well known for whenever the team would go off for a lovely lunch in one of the very many lovely restaurants in Canberra, Alan was the one who ducked down the road to the fish and chip shop and get the battered salve and the potato scallops. I'm not sure if anything's changed, Alan, but it was something... I remember a lot of your contributions, but that's one thing that particularly sticks in my mind. What I want to do today over the next 20 minutes is to spend approximately half of my time talking a little about what's my favourite topic, and that's Australia's natural gas. And then after that, I really do want to talk a little about how we move this whole debate forward in a very optimistic and hopefully constructive way, with some practical suggestions about what industry in particular and the role that industry can play in taking this extremely thorny, complex issue to a new level of understanding, but most importantly a new level of success, both at the international level and domestically. I'm not sure about the rest of you, but certainly in Australia, watching energy policy unfold and greenhouse policy unfold over the past couple of years has been a little like sitting in the audience of a beauty pageant where the judges have at varying times been seduced by a rapid succession of talent, eye-catching, full of come-hither promise and a self-confidence that makes it hard not to agree that whoever is the one on the runway is the one. Clean coal, renewables, nuclear, biofuels, geothermal. And don't get me wrong, natural gas can strut and posture and pose along with the best of them. But in the end, we have to face the fact, I think, that natural gas is perhaps just a little too homely to catch the imagination and the eye of the policy judges. We get plenty of high commendations, but we sort of lack the swoon factor. But what we lack in bling, we make up for in self-assurance, subtlety, and I think endurance. I'd argue that this surely rates natural gas in being given a position on the podium. There's no doubt that energy policy internationally is at a crossroads and in Australia, and this nervousness over the unrelenting rate of consumption growth, evidenced most recently in the International Energy Agency's World Energy Outlook 2007, noting that the world's energy needs could be well over 50% higher than in 2030 than today. Increasing contractions of the sources of oil and gas to fewer countries located in some of the most politically volatile regions of the world, and in Australia, rapidly declining oil production. If that's not enough, then comes climate change. Someone's put the wrong slide pack on here, but never mind. As we heard yesterday, there's no question that the vast majority of international climate change scientists believe climate change is real, that it is in the main caused by people, and that its impact without urgent action any action, in fact, will be profound. And we need look no further than the elements of the fourth assessment report released during the year by the International Panel on Climate Change, the final synthesis report, which I understand is to be released tomorrow, for a very sober and comprehensive overview on the current status of the science and the magnitude of the challenge. Professor Tim Flannery, the 2007 of Australia of the Year, spoke earlier this year on ABC's Late Line program and called for Australia to build the bridge to the new energy future. This analogy, and as you can see, I'm kind of keen on analogies, but has stuck with me in the months since. And while I know that Tim is a very smart man, he forgot to mention that the bridge can be built perhaps not quite out of thin air, but close. The bridge to the future, whatever the future holds in terms of the long-term energy mix, is natural gas. While we must explore, generously support and promote all possible technologies regardless of their deployment dates and present commerciality, we mustn't lose sight of the opportunities that we have now. We are constantly reminded by the scientists of the need to act with urgency, so we mustn't take for granted the options that lie under our very noses. We'll hear a lot more about the longer-term technology prospects after lunch, and they'll no doubt play a very large part in our future energy mix.
but all are limited in their capacity to make a substantial difference over the next decade or two, particularly in their ability to deliver cost-effective baseload energy generation. So in terms of natural gas, just quickly to jump through the benefits of natural gas, it's got a range of advantages as a clean and competitive energy source to assist Australia and the world to make the transition to what will inevitably be a very different energy future. And in Australia, we have a lot of it. We've got 110 years worth at current levels of production, and there's much more to be found. And this doesn't include the coal seam gas, which has become a real domestic juggernaut for energy generation in Australia, predicted to represent around 50% of the East Coast gas usage by 2020. And we're currently replenishing natural gas reserves in Australia faster than we're producing it. And the technology is here, it's now, we don't need to wait another 10 years before we take real action that makes a real difference. Gas is flexible, gas-fired generation is flexible, it can be turned off readily and lends itself to small distributed generation for smaller generation purposes. And compared to most other forms of power generation, particularly in a baseload context, gas is relatively inexpensive to build and can be built quickly. It also provides diversity. So now we're talking about LNG, liquid natural gas, something that Australia is very good at and getting better. It provides diversity for energy importing countries seeking to spread their import risk, secure access to low-cost energy, and at the same time address climate change. Australia is extremely well placed to tap into the rapidly growing Asia-Pacific market in supplying a low greenhouse gas-emitting energy source. And gas is very versatile. Not only is it an efficient source of heat and peak and baseload stationary power generation, it can also be used for transport through LNG, LPG, natural gas and gas to liquids. Not tomorrow, but it can do it today. It's also a very efficient user of water. An air-cooled combined cycle gas-fired power station uses as little as 1% of the water used in a coal-fired power generation, and in a country like Australia, where water is one of our most high-priority issues to be addressed in the short, medium and long term, that's not an insignificant benefit. But greenhouse is where it really hits its straps. This chart, which is from the CSIRO Energy Transformed flagship program, shows that gas-fired electricity has around 30 to 50% of the greenhouse gas emissions of today's coal-fired electricity generation. And this is probably really another take on Brian's increasing decarbonisation of the economy. You can see there on the vertical axis we've got carbon emissions per megawatt hour under a number of different technology scenarios. And across the x-axis there, the thermal efficiency. And you can see the combined gas turbines and Nopal cycle gas turbines stack up extremely well. So Australia has a significant opportunity to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the short to medium term through increasing the penetration of natural gas into domestic electricity generation and resource processing, and by increasing our exports of LNG, particularly to the Asia Pacific region. In fact, the industry is so convinced of the potential for natural gas that it set itself some targets. These have been in control, and targets certainly seem to be the policy de rigueur at the moment. They've been incorporated into an upstream oil and gas industry strategy, of which the Strategic Leaders Report, entitled Platform to Prosperity, was launched in April this year and is now in its implementation phase, with the implementation report due to be released at the end of the year. The purpose of the strategy was to develop the strategic direction for delivering a strong and enduring future for Australia's upstream oil and gas industry. And as Australia's Minister for Industry, Tourism and Resources, the Honourable Ian McFarlane, said when he launched the process in March 2006, the strategy is an industry-led initiative necessary to ensure that the wealth and social benefits of the industry are maximised 10, 20 and 50 years' time. It will articulate a realistic long-term vision for a sustainable oil and gas upstream industry, setting out how to secure its long-term sustainable future. And part of the vision that this initiative has articulated is that by 2017, the upstream oil and gas industry will be recognised as producing reliable, clean energy and delivering substantial wealth for Australia. But specifically, the strategy articulates that by 2017, liquid natural gas production in Australia will exceed 50 million tonnes, or between 50 and 60 million tonnes. At the moment, we're exporting around 13 to 16 million tonnes per annum. That natural gas is, for industrial uses and a competitive feedstock for resource processing will double, and that natural gas usage for electricity generation will represent 70% of total new production capacity. If we realise those targets, this is what it will deliver to Australia. It will make a positive add to the balance of trade in the order of $20 billion per year by 2017. And when you consider that against a backdrop of the extent to which Australia's oil production is declining, that's not an insignificant amount of money, and it's not an insignificant impact on a trade balance, an energy trade balance is going to start to look a little rocky as we see that decline manifest itself as in our trade balance. Obviously, greater energy supply security, but also a substantial increased revenue to governments. For every two-train liquid natural gas project that's built in Australia, around $40 billion is delivered in tax revenue back to the government over a 27-year life span of that project. Again, not an insignificant amount. In relation to greenhouse, realising these goals will result in reducing domestic emissions against a business-as-usual case by 50 million tonnes of carbon dioxide per year by 2017. So that's domestic emissions. If we realise that LNG objective, that translates into avoiding emissions in the Asia-Pacific region of 130 million tonnes of CO2 a year. So to put this in perspective, 180 million tonnes equates to roughly 30% of Australia's total 2007 forecast greenhouse gas emissions, around 600 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent, or the emissions from around 36 million cars, which is more than three times the total current number of private passenger cars on the road in Australia. Just before leaving my gas story and switching to the where to from now from a policy point of view, I just want to mention two things. Britain, through nothing to do with greenhouse gas, greenhouse policy, made a switch to natural gas and reduced its greenhouse gas emissions by around 15%. We've just seen some figures released in May this year, from the US Department of Energy, which showed that between 2005 and 2006 in the US, again, with no national greenhouse carbon pricing policy, they've reduced their greenhouse gas emissions for the first time in many, many years to the tune of 1.3%, and that's despite an economic growth rate of 3.3%. Certainly some of that had to do with the weather, but an awful lot of that had to do with, for a variety of market reasons, switching to gas-fired electricity. So one of the options, moving now to where to from now from a policy sense, one of the options in Platform for Prosperity, the industry strategy, considered to be the most critical to enabling natural gas to find its place in the energy mix, is the need for policy mechanisms that level the energy playing field by internalising the cost of carbon. The bipartisan support for a well-designed emissions trading scheme that recognises the need for transitional measures to address the policy distortion created by the unequal application of greenhouse gas reduction obligations around the world has been welcomed by not just our industry, but most of industry. And the ability to learn from those that have gone before us, the EU in particular, and in combination with the excellent work that's been done to date by the states and territories in the development of their design for a national emissions trading scheme, and the Prime Minister's task force, in the work that they've done, and we've heard a lot about that already, should ensure that if anyone's going to get this right, it should be Australia. In terms of the emissions trading scheme, the Climate Change Task Force within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet is a seminal piece of work, and the people who worked on it need to be congratulated for the amazing piece of work that they've done. But where it's up to at the moment is it's really a skeleton of an emissions trading scheme. And I guess getting back to the beauty pageant analysis, it's still looking a little anorexic. It's living on a model's diet of cigarettes and coffee, and as my mum would say, it needs a damn good steak. But there's an enormous amount of work still to do on that in preparation for any introduction of such a scheme by 2010 or 2011. And a few areas I'll just draw, I won't go into them in any detail, but areas that we'll be looking at, and I would urge all of industry to look at, as well as a number of others. There are a couple I've just mentioned here. The first are the mechanisms and the design features to address the emissions
intensive, trade-exposed industry. We've heard a little bit about that today. There's still an enormous amount of work to make that work. What's an emissions-intensive industry? What's a trade-exposed industry? What's the policy distortion we're trying to address? And at what point do we consider that the countries that don't have similar obligations have got obligations? Is it under some internationally credible emissions trading scheme, or is it through their own domestic policy? There's an enormous number of issues to address in relation to that, and I would urge anyone with an interest of it to become involved in that. Points of acquittal is another issue that will be very interesting. Obviously, we can't have every car driver, we can't have every householder rushing down to the carbon bank to deposit and withdraw their carbon credits. We need to be able to push that responsibility for acquittal upstream, but how far upstream do we push it? Where's the intersection where's the point at which you have control over those emissions so you can actually do something about it, but where it's still efficient to have the acquittal take place? Credits for offsets, carbon capture and storage. And we've already heard that the Australian scheme that's proposed, one of its great strengths, is its coverage, 70% compared to the UK, the EU scheme of around 45%. One of the other features about it too is its ability to take account of offsets. Carbon capture and storage is one of those offsets. How will that be treated? What are the rules for dealing with offsets under such a scheme? And fourthly, monitoring and verification. We've also heard about that. Maintaining the integrity of this scheme is the secret to its success and is the secret to its downfall. We absolutely have to ensure that the monitoring and verification scheme is able to ensure and underpin the veracity and the integrity of the scheme, and that is going to be very, very difficult. While Australian government officials have more than enough on their plates in further evolving our national scheme, giving consideration to expanding the scheme to include New Zealand should also be included in the greenhouse policy to-do list. This would not only improve the efficiency of the scheme by increasing the size and the depth of the market, it would add to the list of low-cost abatement options available to the permit traders by tapping into other technologies that are currently more commercially viable in New Zealand than Australia. Our industry, along with other sectors, has long advocated a portfolio of measures to address greenhouse, and Brian spoke a little about that before. I'm just going to say that we absolutely understand that there's two types of policies that are needed. There's the pull policies, that's the emissions trading scheme, that pulls through the technologies to deliver on the abatement that is set, the objective that needs to be realised, but there's a need for complementary measures, the push measures, if you like, to ensure that the technologies are there at the time that they're required and that they are commercially available to be deployed. That said, in working through what those two sets of those complementary measures should be, they should not cut across or impact on the integrity of emissions trading scheme, including impacting on the underpinning rationale of an emissions trading scheme, and that's to allow the market to seek out least cost abatement options under an emissions cap. And they should not, in theory or in practice, favour any particular abatement option. At the international level, we've been talking a lot about Kyoto and its ability to succeed at an international level, but we're really not making very much headway. And we can talk till we're blue in the face about how we need the participation of all countries, but the fact is every country will come to the table with their own interests at stake, and that's what governments are for, that's why we elect them. We have an international stalemate, and we've had for many years, and no doubt, and no amount of bleating is going to change that. But what will it take to break the logjam? We've got to break this logjam. What will it take? It seems to me that the single biggest thing that could restart, re-energise the process would be the signing of a meaningful bilateral agreement between US and China. And I don't need to explain to this audience why. And I do believe that it's the very special relationship between those two countries that it is actually possible. And I'd like to see more countries and international institutions actively support or put as much energy into achieving that end objective as they are putting into what is ultimately a fruitless task. And lastly, we've heard a number of calls for industry to play a leading role, and I agree. The political landscape is polarised, and sometimes it's even a little bit nasty. And that's within industry, that's not even just between the two political parties. Mainstream industry can and play a more active role in brokering a policy path that's rational, efficient and ultimately successful. They can do this in two ways. They can do it through sectoral agreements, international sectoral agreements. And I've got to say the aluminium industry and the cement industry have been real international leaders in this regard. They don't wait for governments. They've got on and done it internationally through their industry sector. And secondly, by participating in the detail of our policy design work. As I mentioned, there's still a great deal of work to do, particularly around emissions trading. Go beyond looking at what greenhouse means for you in terms of your short-term profit and loss, and immerse yourself in the detail and the knowledge that you have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to influence what is possibly the single biggest and most substantial economic reform that this country and possibly the world has ever had to face. It will touch every person and every business and will fundamentally change the investment backdrop that every company will be operating in. Yesterday, Charles Kolb called for industry to arm and equip itself so it can drive sensible policy directions. I'd be interested in the audience, and I won't ask now because I know I've got to wind up, who feels they are adequately armed and equipped to make the contribution that we need to make at a very detailed level to make this thing work. And I suspect a lot of you feeling a little inadequate. But there are a number of ways you can take shortcuts to deal with that. One would be to participate in the Australian Industry Greenhouse Network, which is a body that exchanges information, collects information, develops ideas and works with all of industry to pursue what is, a very important issue. The Australian Government's Greenhouse Challenge Plus program, increasingly its value will be around developing the capacity of industry to deal with this issue at a practical level. In concluding, I am concluding, Alan. Sorry. In 1980, as a first-year environmental science student, a fantastic professor called Professor Jack Hobbs, he was my climatology lecturer who was also lecturing in environmental science. The one thing that I always remembered is in that course was the discussion and the learning that we had around this thing called the greenhouse effect. This is 1980. And it stuck in my mind, as well as all of those that I studied with, and we're all a little bit green and a little bit red, and I think now I'm just kind of beige, but it stuck in my mind at that time that this is something that is really, really, really scary and something we need to get our policymakers engaged with. That's 25 years ago. I've had 25 very anxious years waiting for, or 27 now, but 25 years of a very anxious time waiting for the time when we'd be able to get the policymakers and the community engaged in this. The time has come, absolutely that time has come, and I do believe that our policymakers want to do something in this. They really want to do something. The debate, unfortunately, has been paralysed by too much finger-pointing, blame-shifting, your model's better than my model, my industry's more deserving than your industry, and, you know, it's we've got to stop that. It's time. That needs to go. We can't squander the opportunity. So I guess my parting message is for all of industry to get down, get dirty, get involved, get informed, and make it work. Thank you.